Radar and Gerald W2OYY, give me a call on the phone if you hear me. Just give me a call on the phone if you want to speak to me. Alright, take back to you, thanks.
Affirmative, W2OYY.
Very fine, Andy. Andy, I can tell you're walking around with a handy talkie. All the important stuff came through, but you did drop out a few times as you moved that handy talkie, but you'd like to know about that. Glad Joe got the message. And, okay, Bob, good luck with that, that troubleshooting. And let us know how it goes. I'm a little bit amazed that you don't have the schematic in your hand. When I do troubleshooting, it's kind of hard to, you can do a visual inspection, you can do a sniffing to find out, you know, what's running hot, what looks burnt. And if you know enough about what tube is being used, you know something about what's the usual voltage drop across the cathode resistor, what's the usual screen grid voltage, plate voltage, you can measure things like that if you're familiar with the tube and you got a tube manual in front of you. But to do serious troubleshooting of a rig, it's awful nice to have a schematic in front of you. Let's go over to Bob number two, KB2, Tango Golf Yankee. What's going on over there in Flushing, Bob? K2LIW, my name is Dick.
I'm going to answer him, Dick, on that tube.
Oh, go ahead, Mel, sorry about that. Go ahead, K2KUY.
Try the tube, such as 6146, 6KD6 rig. The problem was that that 12.7 was a notorious failure. And a number of them that I saw, there were sheets that came around, and they told you how to take out, get rid of the 12BY7. Don't bother putting it in the tube checker because it's going to test good. But the Gardar thing may not be able to drive the final tube. So just replacing it in many cases is the answer. However, the sheet that went around on many radios was to take out the 12BY7 and put in a 6GK6. It's a much better tube. If this is the same sonnet, you do have to make a few changes around the radio. So that's the only thing I can suggest, that the 12BY7 is no good, and you want to back the tube to drive right away. So I remember that distinctly, that that was a chronic problem in a number of radios with that use that 12BY7 as the drive.
So I wonder if that's going to help you, Bob. W2CYK, if you need me. Bill? KQIYW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Did he say, I missed something that he said. Did he say that there were mods required on the 6 Golf Helo 6? Just relay that to me real quick. So they have a couple of those.
Did you say a modification was required when you made that tube change? Mel, go ahead. Mel, go ahead and give that answer. In this case, don't wait for the beep.
Yeah. Put a 6GK6 in. First of all, the 12BY7. Some of them, if it's one of the old rigs that were running on 12 volts, like would be used also for mobile, the filaments are wired for 12 volts. The 12BY7 basically does have a filament sensor cap. So I don't know how it's wired, whether it's wired, which rig it is, whether it's wired for 12-volt filaments or for 6-volt filaments. If it's wired for 12-volt filaments, you got to make a little bit of a change in there to, of course, bring the filament voltage down to 6.3. You have to change the, I think, the lead that goes through the plate and the lead that goes to the screen. This is a lot of years ago, so I'm taking it off the top of my head. I think has to be changed around. In other words, you look in the tube manual, see that the wiring of the plate and the screen and all on a 6GK6 is different from the 12BY7, if I'm not mistaken, Dick. Over.
Okay. So I wonder if that makes some sense to you, Bob, W2CYK, K2RIW.
It does, Dick. Thank you very much. And thanks, Andy and Mel, for that. Really appreciate it, and I'll pass it back for the next question. By the way, Lam's not coming in through the eastern. I am going direct to the west end link for waiting for the jet.
Yeah, I can tell you're doing that. And I've got to do some operation here also. Glad you did that. Alrighty, the next person was Bob, WB2 Tango Golf Yankee. What's happening over there in Flushing, Bob? K2RIW.
Hi, good evening, Dick. WB2TGY. I'm working on an antenna project. I have a 20-element long john 2-meter antenna, and I want to add to it elements for a 440 antenna. I know I'm going to start out with half-wave spacing on the radials and drop it down to quarter-wave, but I'm not sure of the spacing that I'm going to need at the back of the antenna.
Okay, now the thing that you didn't make super clear, you've got a 20-element on 2-meter beam. 20 elements on 2 meters sounds to me like an antenna that's in the vicinity of 20 feet long. That's a really big antenna. You want it to operate on 440. What you didn't make clear is that you're taking the same piece of mechanical hardware and shifting it to a higher frequency, or do you want it to run on the higher frequency at the same time? In other words, it's a two-band antenna, and if it is a two-band antenna, are they going to be cross-polarized? If, for instance, you've got the 20 elements on 2 meters horizontally polarized, and you're going to put on some 440 elements that are vertically polarized at right angles on the same boom, no problem. Easy as all hell, because they're at right angles to each other. They don't see each other. There's no interference, no retuning, and whatever. If you're trying to put 440 elements interstitially diffused in between the 2-meter elements, the 2-meter elements will not get retuned. The 440 elements will get retuned like crazy because of the presence of the 2-meter elements nearby. Or maybe you're going to hang the 440 elements as a separate antenna on a boom extension out in front. As you can see, Bob, you've given me a triple ambiguity. You're going to have to give us some more words as to what you've got in mind. What are the services? What are the polarizations? How much simultaneous? What are you giving up? And so on. WB2TGY with a zillion questions. K2LIW.
And what I have now is a 20-element, 20-foot boom. And I do want to add the 440 elements in vertical and leave the 2-meter as a horizontal antenna. And I'm not sure on the spacing, because I'm going to put about 38 elements on it, but I'm not sure of the spacing.
Okay. Well, let me drop for the beep. You've got a lot more going on than just spacing. Back in the old days, Bob, people used to believe that once you chose the right length for a director, and once you chose the right spacing for the directors, you just put on as many directors as you wanted. And you choose the right length for a reflector, you put it in there, and you tune up the drill element. Way back in the late 60s, early 70s, people used to have very naive opinions along those lines. Nowadays, we now know that when you're building something like 38 elements on a 440 antenna, that's a serious endeavor. The only reason you're putting that many elements on 20 feet of boom is you're looking for a whole lot of gain. In order to get that whole lot of gain, every one of those directors has to have a particular length, they're not all the same, a particular spacing, they're not all the same. If you really want all the performance that that much hardware can give you, you're going to start off with somebody's well-documented design. The design I would start off immediately with is K1FO, Steve Polishin. It used to be WA1FFO, he's now K1FO. If you Google K1FO or WA1FFO on ARRL back issues of QSC magazine, among other places, you will find his well-respected Yagi design, a computer-optimized Yagi design, where he went and confirmed them in the field and did final tweaking. You're building a pretty high-Q structure. And to make all of those directors work correctly, there is no exact spacing, there is no exact length of all the directors. They're going to be changing in spacing, they're going to be changing in length, if you want all the performance I think you're looking for. So it's not just a matter of throwing on elements. And if, for instance, you had Let me drop. If you had a high performance 20 element 440 antenna, and you want to go to a 38 element, common sense would lead you to believe you just throw on 18 more elements. Absolutely not. That director string is a kind of a radio equivalent of a magnifying glass, and it has a certain focal length to it. That string of directors is trying to take a great big chunk of RF energy out in front of the antenna over a big area and focusing it like a magnifying glass down to the driven element. So the 20 elements that were there on 440 in my example, where you're extending it to 38 elements, you're looking for the whole new magnifying glass to have a longer focal length. So when you add those extra 18 elements, all the elements are going to change in length, and all the elements are going to slightly change in spacing if you want high performance. You're tuning a great big brand new antenna with a longer focal length for that magnifying glass, if you know what I mean. So start off with somebody's very good design. The best designs I know of are K1 Far Out, Steve Polishin, or Gunter Hock, DL6WU, Delta Lima 6, Whiskey Uniform. He is the Yagi expert on planet Earth in Darmstadt, Germany, and some of those designs modified for American products, you could say, is the K1FO design. You look up those two references, you choose one of those antennas that are well documented, and you build it exactly as said, and you'll get the performance. Other than that, you can spend a lot of man hours doing computer optimizing and tweaking or whatever. When you build a Yagi with 38 elements, Bob, you're entering a pretty serious design field, and you don't just throw any old stuff in there and pray that it's going to work, because I'm a little afraid that that prayer may not be answered. I think you see where I'm going here. Maybe two teeth.
Okay, here you go.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, DL6WU has a home set of Yagi design tools. You go to his site. He has it laid out in a Excel spreadsheet to calculate all the spacing for you. You know, it's in millimeters as opposed to inches, but that's not a problem.
Very well done, and thank you, Eric, for the information. As you can see, Bob, when you're building more than a three element Yagi, when you're building a three or four element Yagi, yeah, you can take pieces of coat hanger wire, throw it at the boom, so to speak, and it's going to work. But if you really want to get your money's worth out of 38 elements on 20 feet of boom, you'll want to start off with somebody's well-documented design. And Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. He is arguably the Yagi expert on planet Earth. You choose any one of his designs. And as long as you don't change the material too much, it's going to work like a charm. WB2TGY.
H-U-R-I-W in the second half. WB2TGY. Well, that's why I asked it, because I figured you'd guide me in the right direction. I know you can't just haphazardly stick elements on, and especially with the gain that I'm looking for and the type of antenna I want to put together. I thank you, and I'll pass it back to you and the group, and I'm going to start doing my homework.
Yeah, good idea. You're getting into a fairly serious endeavor, and we, Eric and I and Mel, would hate to see you spend a whole lot of elbow grease and have it not work out. Okay, I think the last person you signed in was Bernie, Whiskey 02N. Go right ahead, Bernie, K2RIW.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Question is an old question. It has to do with the computers. I have two here, and I'm trying to make one out of them. And the problem that one of them has a 3.5 floppy drive. I removed it, put it in the one I want to build now. And I did the hardware stuff, but when I start it up, it's not recognizing it. My question is, I think if I remember right, I have to go into the CMOS on startup and tell it that there's a floppy drive there that's now active. Is that what I have to do to get it running?
Now, people who have ever signed into the TechNet know that K2RIW is very light on computer knowledge. I claim to be an RF expert. I hope Eric can help you on this one. Eric is a lot heavier into computers than I am. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Two questions on that, too.
What was the question, Dick?
Okay. Bernie, you're going to have to repeat the question so that Eric can hear it. Go ahead, Bernie.
Hey, I got... Okay, I have two similar Dell computers here. One's about 5 years new, so I'm trying to upgrade from my old one to the new one. My old one has a 3.5-inch floppy drive in it, which I need to put in the new one because of the contest logging program I use backs up to an A drive. It was DOS-based originally, so they made it go to Windows, but it still backs up to A. I need the floppy drive in the new computer. I took the hardware, floppy drive out of the old one, put it in the new one. It's in there and all. Now, to get the new computer to recognize the floppy drive, if I remember right, because I haven't built a computer in 15 years, I have to go into CMOS now and tell it that the floppy drive is there yet. Is there, right? Because I don't want to start changing stuff in the setup and then lose the boot up and have to, start going. I don't want to knock this thing out of kilter. So, my question is, how do I get the hardware recognized, the floppy drive in the new computer? Do I have to enable it in the CMOS startup? Over.
CSW2CYK with a very good answer.
I stand by, Bob. Let's let Eric answer first, and then we're going to get Bob in that order. Go ahead, Eric.
All right, if you're really lucky, the BIOS will let you set up the floppy drive. But you've got to have the floppy drive hardware control. There's a controller chip that has to be in either on the motherboard or external. If you've got the right cable and there's a connection on the motherboard, chances are the BIOS will have it. You just go into the setup and tell it that there is a drive, a floppy drive. You'll find that a lot of the newer computers don't bother to put that in anymore, and there are other ways to actually get that data that's on the floppy disk onto your newer system, but your first bet is to try and see if the BIOS will recognize it. If it is, then you're good to go. If not, then you have to find an alternate way of transferring it. Why you need a floppy drive? Well, if you're dealing with some really old programs, chances are you're going to need it, because in the early days, they actually would hard code into the software. That's what it's looking for. And if that's the case, you can actually use a function within Windows, within the command line portion of it, to redirect that what is an A drive to some other location. And let's give it to the editor now, Dick. Back to you.
Okay, so we've got Eric, Bob, and Mel in that order going to give you answers, Bernie. Bernie, I'm going to turn it back to you to make sure you understood what Eric said before we go to the next person giving you information. W02N, K2RIW.
Yeah, okay, fine. Yeah, thanks a lot, guys. This is great. Okay, yeah, I'm going to try and do the fix in BIOS, and if I'm lucky, it'll work. Otherwise, could get into a controller chip that I might need. And the other alternative is telling Windows to, instead of using the A drive for backup, telling it to find the other location, which would probably be CD-ROM, which would be nice. So, gave you three things to look at here. Go ahead, Dick. W02N.
Okay, the next person with helpful information was Bob, W2CYK. Go right ahead, Bob.
Yeah, very good. Sorry, Bernie. Grab your pen. A couple of things. First of all, you should try to get away from using that floppy, because floppies are volatile. And you can think that you're storing data on the floppy, and then all of a sudden it'll just go bad. Or your data's good. What I would do is, if you have existing data, I would take that data and to another machine, email it to yourself. Take it to somebody that has a floppy and email the files from that floppy to yourself. And I would create a directory on my C drive called something like A drive, A use anymore. Most of them don't. So I just use a handy-dandy USB-based floppy drive in those cases. You can use it in your case to store your data if you want, but I would try to get my data off a floppy drive, or better yet, move to a more contemporary logging application that lets you take advantage of all the capabilities of Windows. W2APJ.
W2APJ for answer. Okay, LPP is the third person in the list of people with an answer. First, let me turn it back to Bernie to see if he understood Bob's suggestion, because you need to fill in that. W02N. Go right ahead, Bob. Bernie, K2RIW.
Hi, thanks, Bob. Yeah. It's not information I have on floppies. What I'm doing is using a contesting program, HF contesting program, written in the 80s. I'm just reluctant to move on because it is still supported. It's become freeware now, and it's written in the program that it should back up only when you're using it. In other words, as you're using it, logging in, it backs to the floppy. Like every hour, it'll do a backup to a floppy drive. And then when you finish, you take it off the floppy, put it on the hard drive, email your contest scores in to the ARRL or CQ. And that's the end of the floppy. So it's just the drive that stays active while you're logging. That word you were saying, you were a little noisy there in the repeater. I don't know if my audio is loud enough here. But you said it was Subs, S-U-B-S, Sugar Uniform Bravo Sierra. Was that the word you would give me there, that keyword? Subbob, W-O-2-N.
You're very close. It's Sierra Uniform Bravo Sierra Tango. The landing tango, but if I heard you, just be dead. November 3, Foxtrot Juliet.com. Go to his website, give him his eager donation that he's asking for, and have access to all the contest logs for almost all the major contests of the world. And including some of them being multi-user for multi-op operations. He strongly suggests that the software is beautifully done. Have a look at it. It does do need duping for you. It looks up on the internet call sign information for you. November 3, Foxtrot Juliet Papa. Back to you.
Okay, I got it. Thank you very much. Back to net. Very good. Great, guys. Great job. W02N.
Okay, hang in there. You got two more guys going to give you answers, K2KEY and LPP. K2KEY, go right ahead, Mel.
W2FPP, answer.
Yes, I know. You're on the list. I told you that. Mel first, K2KEY, go right ahead.
Okay, K2KEY. He's running one of the old Dell computers. Very easy to do it. You'll see down the list that go to My Computer. You'll see something called My Computer. When you go to My Computer, go Add Peripherals, and you'll see it comes down to add. You want to add a printer, add another drive, whatever the heck you want to do, you'll see Add. When you do that, you highlight that, and you can put it in. Very simple. I know what he's doing, but if I do the same thing, I've got an old computer, and also I keep it alive because it's for my logging programs. I've got about 25,000 QSOs or something on it. So basically the same idea uses us, but I'll have a whole pile of disks there because I need so many QSOs, I pull it out and put another one on so that if I ever have to take this to another computer, this old one breaks down, I will be able to, you know, basically download it to a new system. But the easiest way is like I say, go to My Computer, add peripherals, and highlight what you want, and usually, that's all you have to do. Very straightforward, Dick, over. But I know he's running one of the old Dell computers, over.
Come in.
Okay, Alex, also on the list. Bernie, let's make sure you understood everything that Mel said before we proceed. W02N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mel. Not exactly. Add peripherals meaning what? I'm not saving any floppy data. I'm just using a disk that I put into the A drive just for the duration of the contest. which is a couple of days. The backup is on the, it goes onto the hard drive and back to the floppy, just in case of a crash. You got your bin file on the floppy. Once the contest is over, I can erase the floppy. I don't need it anymore. It's on the hard drive, and then I just, you know, write the file that it's saved. But I'm not too sure about adding, what peripheral would I be adding to, what add-on? I don't follow that in my computer. What add-on? Add peripherals and tell us, add-on what?
You've got it, Mel.
Okay, right now that computer is not recognizing that you added this drive, this floppy drive. So when you go to my computer, you are now going to add this, that you'll see. You have that option to add or remove peripherals, such as you want to, for instance, you want to change or to add a printer. You've got to tell the computer. So this is what you're going to do. You're going to tell the computer to add this peripheral drive, this new drive that you're sticking in there, this floppy drive. You'll see it. It's very, very obvious on those old Dell computers. Very simple in my computer to add or remove different peripherals. Go ahead.
Okay, I understand you now. Okay, do it through my computer instead of doing it through the files like Eric was suggesting. Okay, that might be a little safer for me, not to make a bad keystroke there. Okay, I understand that. That'd be great if that works.
Continue to comment.
The computer's from 2000 and the other is from 2005, the newer one, you know, I'm trying to get together. Okay, very good. Loaded with information here, Dick. You got great backup here. WO20.
Okay, hang in there, Bernie. You got two more guys that are going to give you information. One of them sounds like W2LPP, but he said it so fast I didn't get it right. W2LPP, correct me on your call letters, give me your handle, and then your comment. T2RIW in the second end. My name is Dick.
Hey, Dick, it's W2SPV, Frank Baker Baker, Wally. I have a lot of sloppy drives from the sales camp from years back, and in the new computer, they don't have no such thing. So you can go over any of the big stores, and you can buy a slim USB extender sloppy drive. I just bought one about 2 months ago for $21.95. You put your old sloppies in it, you plug it in the USB port, and that's it. Go ahead.
Okay, but, I don't know if my program I'm running will back up to anything else. It defaults like to the A drive. It doesn't know from a USB. It's a little tough in that category.
Now, Dick, let me say a word about that.
Go ahead, Bill.
I know the computers he used in one of the old Dells from 2000 or so. It will support just what I said. Simple. You don't have to go buy or anything. You have it in there. All you have to do is just do what I say. Go to my computer, and you're going to add a peripheral. That's it. They tell you right there. You'll see you can add or subtract anything that's on there now. Like I say, there's times you want to put a new printer on. If you want to put a new printer on, you have to put in the information on a new printer. If you want to take it out, put it in. If you want to change the drive, so whatever. It's all in that section called My Computer, over.
I agree with that.
Okay, Wally, you want to add anything to that?
Oh, well, this one is for Windows 98, 2000, ME, and Vista. So if we don't have the USB port for it, I guess we might as well forget it. Go ahead.
You want any fill on any of that, Bernie, go ahead.
I have the USB port, but I'm saying the software that I'm using doesn't back up to a USB. That would be ideal. I could get it if I could even get it back up to the CD, but right now it doesn't, unless I do that, the changing that I could maybe, Windows to change the sequel.
Comment.
Okay, I think that's Alex, whoever. Go ahead with the comment.
November 2, actually, Juliet, November. I have just a general comment. The gentleman who said that you could add devices in peripherals, he's right. With the old computers, I did it many times. Now, The general comment is that I have dealt with many computers, and I suffered loss of information because of the computer malfunction or the hard drive problem. What I actually used, one of the computer guys told me, is anything that you have, just put once in few years, just put the copy of the mirror copy of the drive. If you want to do it many times, do it many times. But it is a very good solution. Now, what he also did is he created the partition in the hard drive, and he did a mirror copy of the hard drive, and then he installed it in the new computer. Now, all you needed is just the drivers for the new motherboard and all the other devices, like a sound card or whatsoever. But it behaves in that environment like a dead separate computer. So mirror copy is very easy. You just connect two drives together, you run the program, and it does by itself. Half an hour done. Back to you guys, and to the gym.
FL, stand by. That was Wesley. And Bernie, do you need any fill on what Wesley just said? W-O-2-N-K-2-R-I-W.
So I'm okay there. I didn't want to start doing questions and all that. Two more involved. I wanted to keep it simple here. But just to say what Mel said, I went into my computer and I see it'll let me enter or remove programs, Windows components, but I don't see any hardware that it'll let me add.
What you want to do is you want to go to Control Panel.
My computer. Then you go to the system, then you find the hardware. Then in the hardware, you're looking for any question marks. And when you find a question mark or particular device, you try to load the driver or update the driver. It is going to ask you for the update of the existing driver, or it can search internet for the driver. Most likely you have an idea who is the manufacturer of it. You can help to do it. Back to you.
Okay, that was Wesley. And it was a slight double with Eric. Eric, why don't you repeat your message?
Yeah, if you go to my computer, you'll see something that says change the setting. So when you click on change the setting, that will bring you to the control panel. And probably the third or second thing down from the top, it will say add hardware. And you can go through that and add hardware. You know, depending upon how old the program he's using, and if in the program it specifically says, hey, you get a couple of different options that he could do. He could do something called redirection, where that if you plug in, say, a USB key or USB memory or something like that, it may come up as drive F. You can manually either assign A to that drive by doing a command line thing, or you could go into administrative tool and then into computer management, and from there you would go to storage and find that drive that's listed and change it to A. That's another way of doing it, because all the programs, they tended to, if we knew we wanted to use a floppy disk, we would actually hard code into the program A colon. And by redirection or by relabeling a drive, you can accomplish the same task. You can do it simply or complicated. But going on what Mel was saying was not completely correct. Because when you go to my computer, it will say change the setting, which actually leads you to the control panel. Or you could just go straight from start to the control panel, and then start from there. K2IWK2J.
FL, no comment?
FL, we're going to get you in a minute. Bernie, let's see if you understood those messages from those people. Have the O2N, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, fine, yeah. Okay, I'm writing it down. I got a whole page full here. I'm going to start to explore this a little bit, see if I can come up with something. But like I said, I put the floppy drive in, so I don't think the computer even knows it's in there yet. supposedly the Windows didn't recognize it. Usually it recognizes anything you touch. I put it in there and wired in, but it doesn't even know it. I don't think it knows that it's there yet. So, all right, I'm going to go down a couple of paths here and see if I can navigate my way through.
Yeah, if you put the hardware in there, you should go right to the BIOS and turn it on, and then Windows will find it instantly.
That's what I'm going to do. I think that's the easiest thing. As long as I don't have fat fingers on the keyboard, you should be able to get in and out. WO2N, thank you all very much.
Okay, you have another suggestion from Mr. FL, I think it is. Please give me your full call letters, Mr. FL, and your name, and then proceed with your suggestion. T2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, I don't know if I'm getting into the machine okay. I'm out of PA. I wasn't appropriate, but I just got anyway, the call is November 2, uniform, box spot, Lima. The handle is Sam. Am I okay into the machine?
Hey, wait for the beep, guys, huh? Yes, Sam, you're coming into the machine quite well. Go right ahead, UFL, with your suggestion.
Okay, the gentleman seems to have a problem with the drive being recognized as any kind of adding a hardware won't recognize the drive. You probably won't find it. What he needs to do is two things. First of all, I don't know how he added the drive. Did he hook up the cable correctly? There's a red line on the ribbon of the floppy drive cable. It has to be in number one. It has to be set up in pin number one on the floppy drive, and also on the board, on his motherboard, has to be set up. If he's done that, and it still doesn't recognize the drive, there's some problem with the drive. Because it shouldn't have to be added to Windows. Windows should recognize it automatically, and the BIOS should be set up to find the floppy drive. If he's done that, I don't know if he's done that.
Over to you, Bernie.
Okay, all I did was install the hardware. I put the drive in. I took it out of one computer, put it in another, started it up, and it's just like it's dead. So I went in the BIOS, and I don't think it's enabled. So I think that's what they don't use the word enabled, I don't think, anymore, but I don't think it's in the BIOS. So I have to, I guess, do that. I'm pretty sure, I think the ribbon cable was notched, so I couldn't make a mistake there, and the power molar plug looks like it only wanted to go in one way. I think it wouldn't even go in backwards, upside down rather. I think you could try and force it upside down, either plug. But once the ribbon cable has the notch in it, so that's in a slot. And the power wire, it seems like it would only go one way. I don't think I could force it upside down.
Okay, that's fine. Then if the cable's hooked up right and you have to go into the BIOS, on the first page of the BIOS, there'll be like a listing. The first page of the BIOS will tell you about the floppy drive setting to see if there's a floppy drive in the BIOS. If it was installed on a computer, the BIOS would already have it set up. If not, and you have to turn on the floppy drive, it's just a matter of clicking the button, the up arrow, to get the floppy drive to the 144 on the floppy. And then it should work without any problem. As long as the cable is right. I know that there's a slot that's on the board that will go in one way. But I'm not too sure about your floppy drive. Some of them do have slots. Some of them don't. Some of them do, some of them don't. So that's just something to be looking at.
Okay, mine has a slot right about in the middle of the plug. The slot was on the bottom. Sorry to match it with the board. Okay, I'm diving into the BIOS. I think I got enough information here to forge forward. WO2N, great.
Very fine, Bernie. You got the answers from about six people altogether. Let's hope there's enough information buried in all that to straighten it all out. Sam, I've got a question for you. You're listed as Feasterville, Pennsylvania, which is 97 miles from my QTH. And I'm hearing you on the input, and the machine is hearing you on the input, which is a little bit to the west of me. What kind of equipment are you running? How many watts output? How high is your antenna? Etc.
great propagation tonight. N2, Uniform Foxtrot Lima, K2RIW. My name is Dick. Do you often listen to the TechNet? Over to you, Sam.
Yes, Dick, I always listen to the TechNet. I was listening, even when I was in Brooklyn, I just moved out here about a year ago. I have about a 75-foot tower up, and I also have an omnidirectional diamond antenna, and also a beam, a 2-meter 4-foot beam, which I have pointed at that in your direction there. So I do have your signals pretty good all the time. Sometimes propagation a little better than others. Tonight's pretty good. And I tried to see if I could get into it. I wasn't sure if I could get in. I haven't ever tried from out here. But this subject I just happened to open about, so I figured I'd give you a shot. Back to you.
Awful glad you came in. You're doing very well tonight. Just a tiny bit of noise in the background. So I think it's a 75-foot high antenna. I think it's an omnidirectional diamond antenna. How many watts are you pouring into it, Sam? Go ahead.
You know, I'm on the beam right now. Not on the omni. I'm on the beam. I got about 50 watts going through the beam antenna right now. I do have an omnidirectional, and that is also on top of the diamond, the 2-meter 4-foot omnidirectional. And I got the 2-meter 4-foot beam on the tower also. So I can go to 2-meter 4-foot.
Okay, with a little more understanding. The beam, is it vertically polarized, and how many elements? How long a boom?
And how long is the cable on?
No, I just settled for the beam antenna itself. Tell me about that beam antenna. Go ahead.
It's a four element, I believe. One, two, four. It's a four or a five, I'm not too sure. I think it's a four element beam. Four element beam, 2-meter beam. The boom is about I think it's about a 4-foot or a 3-foot boom. The length of cable I'm running is about, from the top of the antenna down, it's gotta be about 100 feet. So the antenna's up about 75 feet. The tower's about 75 feet. The antenna's up about 10 feet on that. So about 10, it's about 100 feet of cable coming into the shack here. And I have a TS-798 base radio.
And that 100 feet of cable, is that hardline now, Sam?
No, actually it's 99-13. I was thinking about running the hardline. But, you know what it is, that hard line is kind of stiff, you know. 99-13 is kind of stiff, but the hard line is even worse. So I didn't want to fool around with that. I just was happy enough to try the 99-13. And I'm glad I'm getting out there. You know, like I said, I never tried to get into the repeater before from out here. So I'm just glad I'm getting it okay.
You sure are. Is it really 99-13 or is it 99-14? The 99-13 is the air-filled RG8 size coax cable, which has a history of being very, very poor at sucking up water after it's been out in the weather for a little while. Whereas the 99-14, the more modern version, has a foil covering right under the outer black jacket before the braid, which keeps out the moisture. So do you think it's really the old 99-13 or is it the newer 99-14 line cable? Over to you, Sam.
Yeah, it has the foil. It has the foil on the outside of the shield. So it's a single strand. It's a single copper wire, and then it's the foil, and then it's the shield. The copper shield. So I guess it's maybe the 14. I thought it was the 13. I didn't know they had two types, but I thought it was the 13. But I might have, they might have sent me the 14.
To my knowledge, the 99-13 is now considered an obsolete product because it has such a bad history of sucking up water. Turns out that the water vapor is able to walk slowly through the outer black jacket and get into the cable, whereas with that foil coating they put in there, that essentially stops that from happening. So it's a much better cable. Sounds to me like even though you may have ordered 99-13, the obsolete product, it was smart enough to send you the 99-14. Sounds to me like you're in good shape. Well done. getting in there very nicely.
Cell phone out at 9913A.
Okay. Is there a difference, Eric, between 9913A and 9914? Over to you, Eric.
Give me a minute and I'll tell you. By the way, the loss at 100 feet is about 2.4 dB.
So a 2.4 dB of loss of the 50 watts he's generating, all 35 or so is getting to the antenna.
Not bad.
He's doing very well. He's 98 miles from me. That's a nice long haul. You must you'll see on the right side of the mountain out there in Easterville, Pennsylvania, there, Sam. Glad you signed in. We've gone through the list of people who signed in tonight with a question, and that may be a brand new list, but there's one other thing that's bothering me, a carryover from last week. For the guys who listened in last week, you know that we had quite a discussion on the subject of Toyota automobiles, the recall of 4.1 million automobiles built since 2006, and essentially all of them are going to be recalled, all model numbers of Toyota, whether it be the SUVs, the trucks, the cars, whatever, are all going to be recalled because of the stuck accelerator problem. And whether or not it's a fly-by-wire system that's got a failure mode in this software or whatever, we're not quite sure what all is going on. However, here's what's bothering me. Let me drop. Let's assume now that from the stories we're hearing, we had a number of people reporting vehicles in a runaway mode last week. Among the people who signed into this net, and it all got started because a woman and her three children died in California because the vehicle went to 120 miles an hour, and no matter what she did, she couldn't stop it. 4.1 million vehicles, 6 months of recovery of recall time means that quite a few of these people are going to be waiting quite a number of months. I just made a very rough estimate. Assume that 1% of those vehicles that are going to be recalled have a problem where they're potentially going to go into the stuck throttle mode, the wide open mode where the engine goes to full power. 1% of 4.1 million vehicles is 41,000 vehicles. In other words, if it was a 1% problem, 41,000 Americans are going to be subjected to a lethal condition over the next 6 months. That's a lot of humanity. That's a lot of lethal condition by my standards. That's a huge problem. The biggest recall in the history of mankind. It's going to cost a lot of money. It's going to take a lot of time. A lot of modifications are going to be required. 41,000 people, potentially, by my mathematics, if it's a 1% problem, are going to be exposed to this dangerous, potentially lethal condition. We kill 40,000 people per year on American highways due to accidents. There's just one brand of vehicle as one potential incident might be affecting 41,000 people. Why in the world haven't we told those people what to do? We told them how bad it is. We told them about the recall. We told them about the controversy. Except for some kind of a memo that was brought to my attention. Somebody mailed me a copy of a memo that has never been put over the news, never been sent to the people who own the car, to my knowledge, which an internal memo maybe of Toyota, which tells you that when the engine goes into the runaway mode, you must put the car in neutral. Push that shift lever into the neutral mode. Yes, the engine's going to go to full speed, and depending on whether or not the computer has got a rev limit to it, and whether or not the hydraulic lifters float, hopefully the engine will not be damaged. But the biggest requirement is to save your life. You've got to put it in neutral. Because once the vehicle gets up to about 60 miles an hour with a stuck throttle, you can stand on the brakes, and there's a high probability it will not stop the car. And your car is going down the road at whatever speed it wants to. And in the case of that woman who died in California with the three children, it went to 120 miles an hour. She's on the cell phone talking to her husband, who was working in law enforcement, and all kinds of conversation took place back and forth. He was not told, he didn't know, to tell her to put it into neutral. And if that doesn't work, turn the key off. Neutral first, key second, is the approximate ways you can save your life. This is one of those situations where you have to think about it ahead of time, because under the panic of the moment, you won't know what to do. In the panic of the moment, you try stabbing the accelerator pedal and hope it'll come back up, if that's what it is, and you stand on the brakes. Well, at 60 miles an hour with a stuck throttle, quite possibly your brakes become glazed, they become overheated, and you do not have brakes, and it does not stop the vehicle. After that, your life is in an awful lot of risk. We gotta tell people to remember to put it into neutral. Whenever that engine does anything you don't like, whether you're in forward, reverse, whatever. One of the stories we heard last week of the person backing out of his driveway, and the throttle went to full blast. And he started hitting vehicles and circling around in the street out in front of his house and whatever. They got to be able to shift it into neutral. That's the only way you can save it. Do not, in my mind, put it into reverse. Do not.
Requester 9126, link clear.
We had a suggestion last week of someone who thought the right answer was to put the car into park. At 60 or 80 miles an hour, I say, no way, Jose. In order to get it into park, you have to go through reverse. The last thing you want to do is to have a car moving forward at high velocity, and you go through reverse. Hopefully, the computer is smart enough not to do it. If it puts that transmission in reverse, my goodness, you're going to create all kinds of damage and jammed wheels and whatever. You're not going to be steering that automobile. And if you could get it into park...
Welcome to the New England Reflector, 912.
Get out of here.
So, what's your point, Dick?
The point is, 41,000 potential Americans are being exposed to a lethal condition without being given the information as to how to survive. Why in the world aren't the news media, newspapers and whatever, telling people to put it into neutral and or turn off the key? That information is the best kept secret in the world. Over to you, Alan.
WB2C, okay. Okay. It dropped. Nick, the point is smooth. Okay. The cop that you were talking about, he didn't know what to do. What kind of cop is this? I mean, you're expecting that from a woman that uses the car as appliance? Come on, give me a break. How many of you know to do that? And I tell you again, the worst thing is to put it on neutral. No way, Jose. You shift it in the first gear that it gets in. The third gear or whatever it is, you shift it low shift it as much as you can. That is the way to slow down the car. Who cares about the engine that will explode? It is your life on your line. So I tell you, business made their money. Who cares about the 41,000 deaths? That's the issue. But back to you, Dick.
WB2C, you guys.
And to XJN, I agree with that. I did that by myself. I had a problem in my car a few years ago. And I did put in neutral. Now, with that high velocity speed, when you do that, at least in my situation, I know that I went to reverse, didn't affect anything. Of course, the transmission is dead after that, but you start the car. Now, with the neutral, not necessarily going to start the car. If your brakes are already damaged, what's going to stop the car? Am I right or wrong? I support Alex and to Israel.
Bill Richard, can I stand by? Okay, yeah. Alex feels that you should go into second or first gear. I strongly disagree. Because when the accelerator is stuck
at 8 o'clock, welcome to the W2VL repeater.
When the accelerator is stuck into the wide open mode, second gear or first gear, give the engine an increased amount of torque to the wheel. If the brakes were not effective when you were in drive, they're going to be half as effective in second gear, one-third as effective in first gear. Yes, the vehicle will be moving slower. You will have no control of what speed that vehicle goes at. And maybe you're going to be down to a flat-out vehicle in first or second gear, and you're moving 30 miles an hour. You're still going to strike the things that are in front of you, and you can't stop it from doing it. My strongly felt opinion is you will put it in neutral. And if that doesn't work, you turn off the key. But neutral is the way to disengage the engine, which is producing all the power that's making the car move at high velocity. Your brakes always have a certain amount of action, but the brakes don't have enough action when the engine is in the stuck, wide-open throttle mode. The engine in that situation has more go than woe that you got from the brakes. In neutral, you will stop the car. In any other gear, I think you will not. So I disagree with you, Alex. And the recommendation, which is not well publicized by Toyota, was neutral. Any vehicle, whether it's stick shift, automatic, or whatever, in the case of an automatic, you can always get it into neutral, no matter what speed it's moving at. I've done this as an experiment on the highway. It works. That's my recommendation. No media has told the people what to do. The policeman didn't know, therefore, you can't blame a person because he didn't have knowledge because he'd never run into the situation. We got to give people knowledge. In my opinion, something like 41,000 American lives are at risk if it's a 1% problem of all 4.1 million vehicles going to be recalled. I'll wait for the beep, Bill, W2CUK. What would you do, K2RIW?
Well, I'll tell you, I once had a problem similar to this in an old Studebaker I had. It had something called No Roll, which was a manual transmission, and on a hill, you would be able to put it in a certain configuration where it would lock, where the brakes would lock. And I had this car, something happened with the accelerator stuck and ran me forward, and even though I had my foot on the clutch, the thing just, it just went nuts. And I think I put it in neutral, but I didn't hurt myself, but I did damage the car. But, yeah, I think your advice is right, Dick, neutral. And I think a lot of people aren't savvy into how, you know, driving a car, you know. It's like, I have a lot of miles. I've probably driven over 250,000 miles for over many years. So, you know, when you become familiar, you can do it. Dick, I have a subject I might want to approach with you for next week if you'd like to hear about it.
Thank you, Wyatt. Bernie, your signal was very noisy, but we're going to give you a chance. And Bill, we've got a couple hours left yet. We'll probably go to your subject tonight, but let's not leave this one yet. There are people who are scared to death to put a car in neutral because they think that the gears will not disengage. In the case of a stick-shift car, you may not be able to get it into neutral if you don't push in the clutch first. To my knowledge, every automatic transmission car, by law, must disengage that engine from the wheels when you put it in neutral, no matter what speed you're moving. Neutral disconnects that engine. And if that engine is in a runaway mode, you've got to disconnect that engine from the wheels. Because beyond a certain velocity, you glaze the brakes and the brakes no longer work. And the car then's got more go than woe and you're thoroughly out of control. You've got to plan ahead of time to put it into neutral. There are people afraid to put it in neutral and or afraid to turn off the key, if need be, for fear that they're going to lose steering and or lose brakes. Although the steering may become very stiff, you still have steering. Although the brakes may become harder to operate, every properly operating car has a vacuum reservoir where you can use the brakes at least once or twice.